Andrew Roberts Gray joins the show now. Welcome, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
You're so welcome. We're talking because you are part of the current exhibition at the Launchpad, and you're paired with WeWork Cohane, and you call your part of the show Parallels. So let's start there. What are the parallels between you and WeWork?
WeWork and I were very fortunate to be among the first four artists that were chosen as part of the Aspen Art Museum Fellowship Program, which started 2 years ago. So they chose four artists. We applied through a very sort of rigorous process, and they chose the four of us to sort of balance out ages and sexes and all of that. So WeWork and I were chosen as part of that. It was a nine-month program, and it ended with a presentation at the Aspen Art Museum in May of 2019. So that's the reason the show occurred. WeWork, Cohane organized the show, and she asked me to be a part of it. Besides that connection, WeWork and I have been fellow artists for about 20 years, and we've been in numerous exhibitions together, and I'd say we shared a lot of aesthetic, aesthetic travels, I guess is a good way to put it.
Your work is far different than hers, but yet you found some commonality. How did that happen?
Well, I think that's mainly the commonality is mainly what people bring to it. We have pretty different practices, so there are some overlaps just because that's sort of bound to happen. But I would say our work is actually fairly fundamentally different.
Yes, very much so. And we'll get to that in just a minute. In your artist statement on the Carbondale Arts website for this show, it says, the paintings in this exhibition parallel are taken from my recent studio practice in which I create layered, painterly, and image-driven works that draw on a number of distinct cultural disciplines. Let's unpack that a little bit. What are the distinct cultural disciplines?
I've for a long time been interested in the landscape. When I left New York City as an artist and moved here to the Valley, on my way out, I guess I wanted to refocus my practice, and I was very cognizant of the development going on through the United States as we drove through to Colorado from New York City. And when I got here, I had never lived in the mountains, so I sort of embraced that starting then in my work by starting to paint the landscape, which, by the way, was not very popular in New York City. The landscape painting was, I would say, outre.
Okay.
So that was sort of a statement in itself to just start doing paintings of landscapes.
Huh.
So that became one thread in the work.
Were you painting realistic landscapes, or were you abstracting from the landscapes? What? Tell me more.
I would say that I was starting to, at the sort of the beginning, by painting existing landscapes, and then I started studying the work of Albert Bierstadt, who was an American artist who popularized the American West. And so through his work, I began to explore the landscape in a historical way. So that was the first time when I started to think about perhaps I could pursue my vision through historical visions. And that began in probably 1993 or four.
Okay. And how long did it take you before you discovered the Chinese and Japanese landscape artists, which is a big part of what you're doing nowadays?
Right. Well, when I grew up in San Francisco, well, not in San Francisco, but near it, I often went to the De Young Museum either with my mother or a family friend. So I was introduced to Asian art at a young age, and it stuck. So my sort of interests, although I'm American, have always tended towards Asian aesthetic, and began when I was, before I was even very interested in art. So as I worked through sort of American landscape traditions, I returned to this sort of desire to understand Chinese and Japanese historical painting, classical painting, starting in about 1000 AD with Chinese painters like Fan Quan, and then moving through other artists I studied that were Japanese artists that painted in the Chinese tradition also. For instance, Chabun is one that I actually quote in this exhibition.
What was it about those painters that attracted you to their work?
It's a very different tradition in many, many ways. For one, just technically, that work in China, Japan, the basis of it was sumi ink or black ink. It was typically monochromatic in many ways, especially the landscape work. And they were after an evocation of reality, not reality itself, an evocation of reality through the kind of human lens. That was more important than reproducing what the eye saw. That's a very different approach than Vermeer's approach and the whole history of European painting. So I'm very attracted to that. And by the way, also there was sort of an interesting cast of that that you could see in science fiction, like many science fiction movies. And science fiction scenes are set in these sort of evocative, desert-like, very spare landscapes. And that became part of my work, too, is exploring science fiction. And there was a crossover there between the images of these Chinese and Japanese painters and these environments that I was interested in science fiction. So that is part of how that all happened.
It's, I don't know, the two, Chinese landscape and science fiction, in my mind, at first blush, the twains do not meet. So that's an interesting tack. That's interesting.
Well, if you think about Blade Runner, which is, they're really city scenes, but they're very Asian city scenes, kind of science fiction scene. But I'm also thinking of movies that used sort of the desert as a background and were science fiction movies. For instance, Robinson Crusoe on Mars was shot in the desert, and it has a very Chinese kind of scene to it, with very watery distance views and desert-like scenes that are very spare and monochromatic. So in my mind, I guess these things kind of came together.
That's interesting. So you found a lot of evocative elements in science fiction, just as you found in the landscape paintings of the Far East?
Yeah. So this was another cultural tradition that has become a larger part of my work. You know, when I was a kid, I was very interested in science fiction. So that's kind of transferred over, and it's become part of my work in a way. For instance, the round pieces called Precipice that are in the show on view at the launch pad have a kind of dystopian scene, and they're painted in a sort of Asian style in a way. The black work indicates the landscape and distance, and then there are pieces of technology abstracted in them and other things. So they're a combination of this historical world from another time and more current images, and those are pushed together right before you.
And what are the elements of so many of those? Let's see, one, two, five. You have five pieces in that series in the show.
Yeah.
There's a gallows. Tell me why there's a gallows.
So when the lockdown started, my mind went back because of the plague, if you want to see the virus as a kind of plague. I started to think about Hieronymus Bosch and Peter Bruegel the Elder, who a lot of their imagery was painted when they worked. The plague was sort of finishing up in Europe, so that some of their imagery has scenes in them of these sort of the breakdown of the social order, and in some of Peter Bruegel the Elder's paintings, there are these gallows that either have just ropes hanging from them free, or they're, you know, people have been killed on the gallows and are hanging there. And it's really, you're not really sure why they were killed. You just know that from the context of the painting, the social order has just come apart. So they have a kind of dystopian look. I mean, dystopia, that idea is a very modern idea, but you know, you look back at those paintings and they are a dystopia. And so the beginning of the lockdown and then the civil rights movement, our new civil rights movement, just put me in mind of those things. And so my response to that has been those round paintings called Precipice that have a landscape background. They have pieces of technology or references to it. There are cell phone towers right next to the gallows, sort of thinking about, you know, at some point maybe the cell phone tower is all we have left of the tree, and then the gallows, for me, sort of indicate this point that we're at as humankind, where we finally arrived at the point where we could erase ourselves as a species. So that's where the gallows came from.
Okay. One of the other elements of that series is also carried through into all of your current work on plexiglass. We'll talk about the plexiglass in a minute, but one of the things that one of the elements that are common to both of those things are how should I put it? Schematics or digital. They look like computer circuits. Is that intended?
Yes. So let me step back again and go back to when you quoted my statement. So the fields that I'm interested in my work are the history of the landscape, which I've mentioned, science fiction, another personal interest, but one that's very interesting because it has history of science fiction, and science fiction are always trying to look forward. And I like the idea of science fiction that it's always about the kind of hope for the future and the fear and the kind of fear of the future. So it has those two things. And then one of the other fields that I'm very interested in is the history of the computer. So when I arrived here and started working on the landscape, a friend of mine, about 1994, gave me a box of circuit boards. So, you know, they came out of PCs, and they were just a jumble of them. And I started looking at them, thinking about them. And at a certain point, those circuit boards and their patterns moved into the landscapes. And I started to think about them as man and nature, the landscape in a very simple way, nature. And man represented by the circuit board.
That's interesting. The idea of computers and the idea of an evocative Chinese landscape doesn't jive. So there's a certain tension in your work just from that.
Definitely. Yeah. So I love that tension. So those aren't things that you would normally put together at all. So I really like the idea of this history of a tradition that's not even you know, my direct tradition as an American. It's from another time, another age. And then, you know, the whole history of the computer and the thinking machine as a field in itself. And if you think of those two broad things, just the landscape and the history of the computer, to me, to try to put those together, as you say, there's tremendous tension there. And it's very open to interpretation and to investigation. I mean, the combinations of those things are sort of infinite.
Open to interpretation. You know, that's an interesting concept. I can't say that a lot of artists are as open as you are to that.
Well, everybody takes a different stand to the meaning in their work. So what I mean by that is that some artists want to control your experience as the viewer and what you're taking from the work. They want to track that. They want to give you a certain experience that they control to a certain extent. And then on the other side of that, or at the other end of that perspective, maybe there are artists who want to just present their vision of sort of where we are as humans and let you make your evaluation and your response to what kind of meaning that contains. So, and I'm that kind of artist.
Yeah.
I want to create an environment, an experience for people that makes them ask questions about what they're looking at and where they are as a human. What, you know, what are the conditions of our lives now? What matters to us? So, does that make sense?
It does, very much so. And you know, that's a much more open-ended, tolerant approach. It's not like that guy that, you know, pissed on a crucifix and called it art, right? I mean, you know, that's not open to interpret. Well, maybe it is, I guess, but...
If you were to look at all of his work, I know it's Andre Serrano you're talking about, and
yeah,
if you were to look at all of his work, not just that one piece, I think you would understand and have a different perspective, because a lot of his work was about sort of reactions to the controlling influence of Catholicism and Christianity in his life. So that's sort of where that came from. But most people aren't aware of that. So I'll just say that is a throw that out. But on the other hand, you know, in terms of my work, I'm also not, it's okay if there's narrative in my work. It's okay to me if there's some entertainment in terms of like things for people to look at, ideas for people to engage in. And if they have their own experience through my work, that's fine with me.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah. Andrew, your work nowadays is characterized by working on plexiglass. And I was privileged to visit you yesterday in your natural habitat, in your studio, and got a little bit of a sense of how that works and how you handle that material. Have you been working on plexiglass since the beginning of your art career? How did that come about?
No, not at all. Although in printmaking is part of my background, there is a kind of technique called monoprinting where you paint on plexiglass, put a piece of paper on it and run it through a press, and then you get an image. So I did do that. So in that sense, way back in the day, I did use plexi in, you know, part of making artwork. But about 6 years ago, I was doing a lot of materials research, and plexiglass is one of the materials I ended up using in a body of work that was very abstract, because I like the materiality of it. To me, it's the modern material to me. It really... As I talked about the computer being significant of us as humans in an abstract way, to me as a material plexiglass is, because it's plastic, and that's the most, it's sort of the most ubiquitous man-made material right now. So when I started a new body of work, I had worked with mirrored plexiglass, which is like a normal glass mirror. It has a coating on the back of it and mirrors just like mirrored glass, but it's much lighter and you can manipulate it easily. And a friend here at my studio, Allegheny Meadows, was sandblasting his ceramics at one point to get a different texture on the surface of his ceramics. And I had a piece of plexiglass that I had painted on, and I asked him one day, could we just try sandblasting this for fun? And we tried it, and we both were like just really excited by what we saw. And when I saw the way the sandblasting changed the quality of the plexiglass and took off, erased some of the paint, and the tracks of that erasure were left, I saw this whole body of work on mirrored plexiglass open up before me. And so since then, the last 4 years, I've been working with this material, making paintings on it.
So you paint on the plexiglass, you screen print your computer circuit board
imagery, textures,
and then you sandblast.
Sandblast it so I can take material off and I can change the actual quality of the plexiglass. So I'm really, it sort of becomes material science in a way. And it changes the surface so that when the viewer goes to see it, it's not a normal canvas surface. It's not a normal piece of paper. And so it gives them immediately, the viewer, a different environment to confront as the viewer. And it makes it sort of easier in a way for me to introduce ideas that might not normally go together because they're presented on this material that's unusual.
Well, it also sort of gives it a 3D aspect, too, when you're looking at the piece, because there's some depth of perception in,
yeah.
I guess, depending on how thick your plexiglass is. But, and also the mirror coating in the back of it adds a certain element of 3D-ism.
Right. What I found is that by sandblasting the plexi, when you look through that plexiglass, as it gets more occluded, then the sheen from the mirroring changes, and it gives everything a sort of ethereal depth. And that's supported, luckily, that, you know, it's one of those lucky things that happens to artists sometimes. That quality seemed to support my conceptual and painterly things that I was doing. Mm. So that contrasted really well with my brush strokes, with my evocations of landscape, with these screen printed, very flat digital things I was doing. And it sort of was just a lucky coincidence of approaches that people just enjoyed looking at.
You mentioned that the sandblasting sometimes erases some of the paint or anything.
Yeah.
But you can't erase the sandblasting, can you? I mean, so I guess, or can you? I mean, it's...
Well, I've gotten, you know, as anybody would, working on it for years now, I've gotten so that I have a lot of techniques for taking off a very little bit of paint, but still changing the quality and still having a sort of depth in the plexi and sort of just learning all the different things I could do with the plexiglass. Sometimes now I erase the mirroring in the back of an area and paint it. That color comes through the plexiglass. It has a different quality than the paint sitting on the front of the plexiglass. Uh-huh. So I've just acquired more and more, you know, different sort of technical things I can do that support my ideas.
But I guess what I'm saying is the sandblasting has to be last because you can't really reverse the sandblasting, can you?
Well, not necessarily, because you can always go and paint back over that.
Oh, okay.
And that mark painted back over, sandblasted marks, will have a different quality.
Oh, okay.
So there's really a lot of places to go. Huh. And I'm still learning about them. I kind of considered moving away from the mirrored plexiglass the last few months, and then I just realized that there's just a lot more to experiment with.
It must have been a really exciting moment in your artistic evolution to discover the possibilities of plexiglass.
Yeah, it was really an amazing time, and if you ask Allegheny, the look on my face, I think, when this happened was sort of timeless, I think, because I really could see where this was going, and there was something about this discovery that also related to my layering of imagery and my layering of cultural reference. And so, you know, there were these different parts of my practice that were focused through this technical discovery.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Amazing.
Yeah. I am by no means familiar with the whole breadth of the art world, but are there too many other people that are doing what you're doing with plexiglass?
Well, there's a lot of material experimentation. Part of what I chose to do came from was over the last 20 years, I would say, many, many artists have chosen to use a material as the basis as painters or sculptors that we hadn't experienced before in art. And just as I talked about how that allows the viewer a new experience, that was part of this whole movement. By using these alternative materials, materials not associated with art, I think artists felt like they could get across something to the viewer that was new and unusual and give them an experience that was fresh.
Huh. I can't imagine plexiglass is very forgiving.
No, it's not. And it can be, the bigger it gets quite heavy too. So, you know, there are challenges to it, but one of the advantages, on the other hand, is it's dimensionally stable. So one of the problems with all artistic supports is if they change their actual size over time, you get cracking and whatever with the paint.
Oh, I see.
So, you know, there are advantages to it too. I mean, probably some of my plexiglass works will definitely be around for hundreds of years if they're not destroyed, because they're not going to decay very quickly. So.
So when they get discovered by an alien civilization somewhere down the line, they're going to look at that and scratch their head.
Oh, they'll be scratching their heads on it. And that would be, you know, that's sort of one of the goals. I mean, not all artists, but I think a lot of artists would like their work to survive them, to be something they give to the future generations, if there are, and to be a record of our time and vision of the future and vision of the past from 2020. You know, I feel very fortunate that I get to go to my studio every day and make things, you know. So,
one of the things you said to me yesterday when I visited your studio, Andrew, was that this has been a real boon for your art career, working on plexiglass. And it happened fairly late in your career, fairly recently.
Well, I sort of remember the conversation, and I'll say that, you know, I began making artwork about 1979, and I didn't really do it when I was a kid. So I wouldn't say that I was blessed with a lot of natural artistic skill, a nice way to put it. So it took me many years to find the technical abilities to make things that were intelligible, to find ideas that that were important to me and that perhaps other people would be interested in, and just to find my vision as an artist. It was a long, long process, really 40 years. So, you know, probably the plexiglass works didn't happen until 35 years into that process.
Wow. And, so you kept
so
with
I had
it.
To I had to be patient, you know, that was I had to be stubborn and patient and just make art because I liked making art, and then it sort of I outlasted my boredom.
Oh.
And I outlasted you know, a lot of other things, and just kept making work, and then I think I just slowly got better at it.
And yet, you kept the faith for that time.
I did. Kept the faith. I think that's probably the best way to put it. I just kept the faith, kept making work.
And now you're in the enviable position of making your full living from your art.
Yeah. Never thought I would get here, and it's wonderful. And every day, I'm pretty happy coming to the studio and making work. I don't sell a lot, but I sell enough that it kind of gives you this keeps you happy in a way. It keeps you feeling like you're contributing, and then I still have my just natural desire to experiment and to test my vision and to try to find ways to look at where we are now and the future and recombine those things with our past and find a new reality, sort of.
Where do you see your art evolving to, or is that sort of a moot question? You just sort of take things as it comes. What's going to happen for you in the
No, I actually think about that more than I used to, I would say. I really am excited about these fields that I've found for myself, the landscape, the history of the thinking machine. Another field that I'm interested in and I explore to some degree is the story of the Hindu god Ganesha. And I weave that in its unusual qualities with all of these other things. So I'm going to just keep working on these fields and finding ways to combine them that excite me. Uh-huh. So that's sort of my future. I'm really interested in some of these images from Peter Bruegel and Hieronymus Bosch, and that's sort of something that just recently happened. And you know, it just infuses me with the past and the future.
So does that mean you have a trip to Amsterdam or wherever the Bosch paintings are hanging right now?
Yes.
Oh.
I would say yeah, because when I was 18, I was in Europe, and one of my experiences that definitely pushed me into being an artist, since I was not an artist in high school or before, I was at the Prado and saw The Garden of Earthly Delights by Hieronymus Bosch. And I remember that experience. It's very clear. And I was so struck by it. I remember it was extremely hot when I saw it, but I just was so apart from reality. I think I was there a really long time. I went to see it quite a few days in a row. It was hard to, there were a lot of people. And so now I think it would be wonderful to return to see that painting. There's also some in the Prado, there are paintings by Peter Bruegel and, of course, in different places in Europe. So, yeah, I think I would like to do that. And on the other side of it, I haven't really explored and gone to see some of the Asian works that I've studied over the last 5 years. So the last 5 years, I've really studied a lot of Chinese, Japanese paintings. And with that new knowledge, I would like to go see some of these things again and experience them directly, stand in front of them and see how that feels.
You can only get that from standing right in front of it, can't you?
Exactly. Yeah. And that's the beauty of artwork, is that, you know, we have all these digital means now and video, but it just doesn't cut it.
Yeah. You know, Bosch and Bruegel, full of dystopian imagery. Is that sort of the direction you're going to?
Yeah, definitely. And if you, as we discussed yesterday when you visited the studio, Bruegel's painting, The Tower of Babel, you could see as a science fiction painting. It's a painting of what the future might have brought to them. And Bruegel was thinking about the hubris of man. He was thinking about how does technology change our world? It's a tower that reaches up into the sky, and the kind of context of that tower is sort of decaying as it's being built. So I think he was onto something, and I think Hieronymus Bosch's imagery, a lot of it, if you look at the actual individual images in the Garden of Earthly Delights, some of the structures, they're very strange, and they have a real quality of science fiction to them, to me, the way they look. They're from his mind, definitely.
Yeah, an opiated mind.
Yeah.
Or something. Yeah.
Yeah.
He was definitely on a different track, wasn't he?
Well, I think he was good enough artist that he could draw you in with, he could paint things the way they appear, and he was so good at it that he could also paint your fears, and I'm sure there were narratives or stories that are part of some of the imagery in Bosch and Bruegel, and we're not familiar with it now, but it probably made sense to people then.
Huh. Yeah. Well, you know, with your interest in layering both materials and subject, it is of a piece of enjoying Bosch and Bruegel, I would say. They're very similar that way.
Yeah.
Lots of detail.
And really, go ahead. Sorry.
Lots of detail.
Yeah. Detail, narratives, but the final experience is sort of, it's not pedantic on the artist's part. It's giving you all these experiences, and you have to make sense of it. I mean, what does it mean to see a woman being spirited away on a fish in the sky?
Yeah, that's interesting. Wow, lots and lots to chew on with your art, and I guess that's the point, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's what I've chosen to do with my work. There was a point in my practice where I could have gone in a more minimal direction, and I rejected that and decided to go this other way. And this layering, as you say, of technique and materials and references to history and to where we are now. I think that's where I want to go.
Andrew Roberts Gray, thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, thank you very much, Luke. I really appreciate being part of the KDNK world.